My name's Scott Redman. I'm an alcoholic. And Rita, you did not talk too long.
Thank you, Scott.
I'd like to thank Rick T. for asking me to come and share today, and I'd like to thank everybody associated with the Roundup and putting this function together. I've been shown tremendous hospitality and kindness since I got here. Me and my younger son pulled in last night with our friend Polly. And I'd like to welcome all the new people, Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a great life today, and if you're new here, I'm sure that thrills the shit out of you. Because I know how terribly glad I was for everybody who was having a good time in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here. I was really happy for them. I'd sit in my seat and I'd listen to them talk about the new house and the family and the new car, and I'd say to myself, well, geez, you know, maybe you'll go home tonight and maybe your house will blow up, you know? Maybe your family will blow up, you know? Maybe you'll blow up, all right? Then we'll see how spiritual you are next week, all right? So if you're new here, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're an alcoholic, if you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts, if you're a dope juggernaut, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And just suggest that you stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. Just catch alcoholism. Catch alcoholism. It'll be our pleasure to give it to you. Just catch it, because we have a book for alcoholism. We don't have a book for dope fiend, you know, dope behemoth. We just have this book about alcoholism. If you're new here and you don't have alcoholism yet, I just want to tell you, I did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain. And, yeah, I'm sure your Catholics can't relate to that at all. When I was new in AA, I heard this lady share that she was ex-Catholic, which meant she didn't believe in God anymore and was positive God was going to come and get her for feeling that way. And man, I understood that. I was introduced to an Old Testament God when I was a kid, and I was sent to Hebrew school. I was a hip, slick, cool kid growing up in the Bronx in New York City, and my Hebrew name was Shlomo. I'm not, if there are any Shlomos with us today, I'm not knocking Shlomo. I just, I wanted a Shlomoectomy. I wanted to get out of Shlomo. I wanted to get out of Shlomo as fast as I possibly could. I was stealing cars and hanging out with my buddies and doing the deal, and I was introduced to this Old Testament God that I would not be caught in a dark alley with, man. This guy got you. He got your ass no matter what. He turned your wife to salt. He killed your goat and put a finger in your eye, and he killed you no matter what, no matter where you went, and no matter what you did. And I wanted out of that, really out of it as fast as I could. So when I got here, I was Jewish, so I couldn't be an alcoholic, and also, I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not putting therapy down. It says in our book on page 133, if you need a doctor, go get one. That's pretty clear. But as a treatment for alcoholism, my therapy was worse than useless. It was dangerous because I was doing good work in therapy and I was dying from alcoholism. I was going to be dead with no Oedipal conflict at all, but I was going to be real dead. Now, it makes sense after I found out what alcoholism was. It made perfect sense to me. If alcoholism is a threefold illness, if it is a bizarre physical allergy to alcohol coupled with some very interesting, unique thinking, and the thinking and the physical allergy mix together and create a cancer of the soul, a soul sickness that places alcoholics beyond human help. If it is threefold, and I'm trying to treat that with psychology, which would be mental, which would be onefold, I'd be twofold short. And which kind of explains why my whole life I felt like I was showing up at a gunfight with a knife. You know, I never felt well prepared. And And in addition to being in psychotherapy for 18 years, I was not an alcoholic. I was a dark, complicated artist, and but not an alcoholic. So I was an artistic Jewish patient, I guess is what I was, but I wasn't an alcoholic. So if you're new here and you don't have alcoholism yet, stick around. They're going to lie to you and they're going to tell you that you can't catch it. And they're lying. I caught alcoholism from you. You gave me alcoholism. I got alcoholism in these meetings. I got a lousy case of it today. And I didn't have it when I got here. It's a weird, weird disease. If you catch it, you can live. And if you don't catch it, you die from it. I was brought up in the Bronx in New York City. Anybody from the Bronx here? There we go. One person on the witness protection program here. So that's kind of nice. I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry, Frankie. I was going to lie and say I was sorry. And I was brought up in a completely insane family. My family, my wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came to the party and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. And it wasn't a mistake. It was a look she was going after, you know? She even wore it sort of jauntily askew, kind of beret style. If you got something for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And her husband was a welder, and he used to bring home bales of free steel wool. And she took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with the steel wool. Now, after a while, that stuff works its way through on you. So when you'd go to their house, everyone was moving. Everybody was moving a little bit. The whole room was kinetic. It had a real, its own spin on it. My uncle was one of the top 10 welterweights of the world during the 30s. And I wish I was lying about this, because this is my genetic pool. He was fighting down in Atlanta, Georgia in 1939. His name was Isidore Redman, and he changed his name because he was concerned about anti-Semitism and changed his name to Isidore Goldberg. Oh, man. He figured they'd think he was German. Germans were pulling in a lot of fans in 39. Oh, man, oh, man. And if you're new here, all I've got is good news. My family did not have one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. Not one thing to do with it. I'm not saying they weren't nuts. They were nuts. I'm not saying a whole lot of damage didn't get done. It did. I'm not saying that I didn't have to do a whole lot of stuff to take care of the damage. I did. I'm saying they didn't make me an alcoholic. I can't tell you how important it was for me to understand this. And if you're new here, it might sound confusing because you might have a family that's hurt you real bad, and you might be real angry at them, and you might want to really, you know, show them what they've done to you. They've gotten you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're anything like me, you're sitting around your seat, and you're looking around the room, and you're saying to yourself, Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond synagogue, beyond church. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. Welcome. If my family made me an alcoholic, I could go to psychotherapy, I could work out my family problems, and I could drink like a normal person. I wouldn't have to go to parties anymore and say, oh, no heroin for me, I'll have a Perrier. I wouldn't have to do that. I could just be there like the normal folk. But it doesn't matter how much psychotherapy I go to, it doesn't matter how much I work on those problems, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't work on them. It's an outside interest as far as I'm concerned. I'm saying that I couldn't treat my alcoholism with it. If they had made me an alcoholic, that means I could work on my family problems and clear it up, but they didn't. And if you stick around long enough to take the alcoholic test, if you're new here, we do have a test for alcoholism. It's called an inventory. It's a pass-pass situation. All you have to do is do it, and you pass. And if you do it, you get to see the picture of your disease. Other diseases have blood tests and x-rays. We have an inventory. And sometimes guys I sponsor, they'll work on it a little bit and they'll call me and they'll say, geez, you know, can I just come over and read you what I got? This, you know, it's really awful. And I encourage them. I say, you know, can you wait? Can you wait and take a look at the whole thing? At the whole mess? I'm resentful at them. I'm resentful at me for resenting them. I'm resentful at them for watching me resent them. All right? And I've had sex with all of them. All right? I don't know how I got anything done. I really don't. I don't know how I got anything done. And if you're new here, I'm talking about the disease of alcoholism as it's outlined in our book. It's outlined in chapter 5. It's described as the soul sickness. If we take care of the soul sickness, we seem to straighten out mentally and physically. The other two folds seem to fall in place if we take care of the spiritual malady. And it's composed of resentments, fears, and sexual problems. And growing up family in the Bronx, and thinking that I was going to make everything right by going to psychotherapy, I, in addition to committing to therapy from the age of 14 on, and thinking that this self-knowledge was going to get me out of this spot I was in, because bad stuff started happening almost immediately to me. I sold heroin to a New York City policeman. Bad stuff, not my fault. He wasn't wearing a uniform. I didn't know he was a cop. what I did, in addition to the psychotherapy, was I drank until I didn't want to be a drunk. I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here today. You remember WOW, right? WOW. WOW. And right after WOW usually came, what? What? WOW. What? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum, right? There's like a lot of activity, but no movement, you know? Nothing catches and moves forward. I triumphed over marijuana with pills. I was victorious over pills with cocaine. Cocaine's a good drug. It's particularly good for sex, if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I got out of that cocaine problem with heroin. Heroin's a good drug. It's a dark, artistic drug, and then you cross the line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump. You don't want to do that too long, so I stopped taking that heroin and started drinking. Took up drinking again. And I swapped addictions, and I managed to avoid getting the disease of alcoholism. My father thought he was a real loser. And I absolutely agreed with him. I just thought he was a sap, you know. My dad never made more than $10,000 a year. My brother and I never missed a meal and never went to school with ripped clothing. My last year out there, I made $80,000. My children did go to school with ripped clothing, and they did miss meals. How had that happened? How could such a thing happen? Put those two pictures down right next to each other and examine them, and how does my dad come up a loser? He comes up a loser if a certain kind of thinking has become a step. If I'm somebody with alcoholic tendencies and a certain kind of thinking comes established in me, I can leapfrog over logic and reality and come up with the fact that my dad was a loser, and I certainly wasn't going to be mistreated like him and work and make an honest day's wage and bring it home. I was in my late teens, and my dad had a massive stroke, and I was stoned on heroin. I had shot some heroin, and I was brought to the hospital, and I couldn't be there for him when he was dying. The sound of the heart machine didn't get through the curtain. The curtain was down. My curtain was down, and I couldn't show up for him. And I felt like a pig, like an animal. It was certainly something I was never, ever going to live down. It's something that I don't know if my family knew or not, but I certainly wasn't going to tell anybody this. And anytime I even thought of my father, I couldn't bear it. It was one of those, you know, those horrible memories that all you do is wince like you've been blindsided by a brick. And I walked through his funeral like a zombie, and I swear I'd never put a needle in my arm again, because that was the problem. And I didn't. Shortly after this, I met a woman, a remarkable woman. Beautiful, intelligent woman. She was exotic. She was from Detroit. And I didn't know anybody outside of New York. I really didn't, you know. And I met this woman, and I just plummeted into love with her. I was acting in a Broadway show, and she was an usherette in the theater, and it was incredibly romantic. And I just now, if you wrote down everything I did in 8 years of marriage, and you gave it to this woman, and she read it, and you said, "Would you live with this?" No, who would live with this? But by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a book on the bestseller list. I'd acted on Broadway. I had directed a TV show. I had directed a film. I had had my own theater in New York. I did all of these things a time. I never got to do any of them more than once, because when I'd leave, they'd move the business so I couldn't find it again. Because people were horrible to me. And when I took that alcoholic test, when I took that inventory, I saw that early on, people were doing things behind my back. A little later on, they started talking behind my back. And in the last few years, they were thinking behind my back. Right? That's a terrible thing. It's hard to catch them. but you can get them. You can catch them. You can trick them. And my wife, if you live with an active alcoholic, you had better get yours or it'll be gone. Doesn't matter what I say over here. Doesn't matter. When I start the walk to the drink, quite often I'm telling the truth. Gets a little murky over here. It's quite often an out-and-out lie by the time I get over here. But quite often I'm telling the truth over here. They made a film about Bill W. some years ago. I didn't much like the film very much, but there was one thing in it I loved. Every time he screwed up, he looked into the camera and he went like that. Man, do I understand that. I really get that. So, Nancy, you know, some people are attracted to damaged people, you know, and I know that's true for them, and I'm not. I'm attracted to healthy people, and then I screw them up. And Nancy got sick from prolonged exposure to me, and boy, we were terribly ill by the time we got to the program. At one point, a guy lent us his car, and we sold his car. We sold his car. I'll never forget this guy's voice on the phone. He said, "You sold my car? I lent you my car. How could you sell my car?" 15 years later, when I called to pay him back, his voice was exactly the same. He said, "You're paying me back?" It's like he had been frozen at the end of the phone all that time. I ripped this guy off for a couple of $1,000 in Michigan. I did some teaching for him up there at this university hospital. And this guy made copies of the checks that I had passed on him with my signatures on the back and wrote a letter explaining exactly what I had done. And he sent a copy of it to my in-laws, my mom, and to every person he knew in my family or anybody he knew I had known or ever worked for. Aren't you glad that didn't happen to you? And I was in my father-in-law's house when he got the letter. And I saw a little piece of him die that day. And through all of our adventures, through all of our misadventures, I saw a little piece of him die, I saw a little piece of Nancy die, and I know a little piece of me died. And every time a little piece of me died, a little more ice formed around my heart. When our older son was born in New York City, 16 years ago, we were surrounded by friends and family and flowers. There was a ton of phone calls. We were right in the pocket, man, right in the community, right in the middle of our family. 2 years and 9 months later, our younger son was born in Los Angeles. There was nobody there. There was no phone calls. There were no flowers. There were no family. We had completely isolated ourselves in those 2 years and 9 months, and the ice around our heart had become so thick that the people who loved us, we had either repelled them or it was just too painful to be around us. It just hurt too much to see what was going on, and people stayed away. I was working for a restaurant in New York, and I stole a lot of money for this guy because I wasn't going to let him treat me like a sucker like my dad, you know. We took a belated honeymoon to Italy. And when your coffee man takes his wife to Italy, there's something wrong you know, in the way the business is happening. It's really, so we go, we're staying on this lake in the Italian Alps in a medieval village. Probably enough for a normal person. They'd like it, you know, it would be enough. But they were making cognac right near there in the hills there. And so I was drinking a couple of bottles a day, and I finish a bottle of cognac after dinner one night, and I look up, and Nancy's giving me the rat face, you know, this. The rat face. The full rat face, you know. I said, "What?" She said, "Well, what are you doing, you know, to the bottle?" And I said, "Sweetheart, this is fresh cognac. They make this right here. This hasn't had the time to develop the alcohol content that the cognac back in the States has. It's fresh." I came home one day, we had these iced tea tumblers, and I popped a cork on a bottle of wine, and I emptied the whole bottle of wine into the glass. And I look up, and I'm getting the rat face one more time. And I said, "What?" And she said, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." "Can a man have a glass of wine in his own home?" And she threw up her hands and walked away and said, "What a moron." And I looked after her and said, "What an idiot." And it just chipped away at us. And our sons became grievously ill from alcoholism. By the time I got sober, our older son was making involuntary clicking noises with his throat that he couldn't stop making. He tested in excess of 168 IQ, and he could barely read or write. He was in the second grade, and he was reading and writing way below his grade level. He was diagnosed more or less as functionally retarded, and he was cut off from the society of other children. Fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble, and how horribly true for the young people who are exposed to alcoholism, because it never works out. It just never works out. And the kids in these alcoholic homes, the kids in my alcoholic home, lived in this half-lit world where it doesn't matter what I say over here. It doesn't matter. By the time I get over here, the bike money can go for alcohol. Anything can happen. And if you're my kid and you're in between me and the drink, either I got to walk around you or I got to walk through you. You either have to vanish or you have to turn into a papier-mâché figure. And if I'm walking around you, I have to walk bigger and bigger circles because it hurts too much to look at you at all. And the boys, how much vanishing can you bear before you believe what you're being taught, which is that you don't exist? And that's what happened to the boys living in this alcoholic home. On April 22nd, 1985, I was seeing a Jungian therapist at that time. It was my first Jungian therapist. And on April 20th, actually, I put a needle in my arm again. I had not put a needle in my arm for 13 years, and I crossed a line that I swore I would never cross again. And I called up my therapist, my Jungian therapist, and I told him what I had done, and he said, "Scott, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." And I said, "What?" He said, "There's nothing I can do for you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized." Now, I guarantee you, on any other morning I can remember, I would have said, "Let's go to the institution. That's fine. It's a chance to meet more adventurous and colorful people, you know. My people, you know, get some good drugs and do this right." You know, in my last few years, I got excited when they told me I needed dental surgery. That's a source of uninterrupted narcotics for a period of time, you know. Normal people don't get excited when they're told they need dental surgery. They don't. They don't go, dental surgery. They don't get perky and peppy from dental surgery. So I went to an AA meeting, and I don't know why. I came home and poured myself a glass of wine, and I'm getting the rat face again. I said, "What?" She said, "You went to..." I said, "Honey, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous are civilized people. You have a glass of wine. You don't stop drinking completely. They're not off the deep end." The next day, I went to another meeting, and I had sent some money to Texas for some drugs, and they had arrived, and they were already paid for, and it was incumbent upon me to take them, and it was a new drug called ecstasy. That doesn't happen at the Lions Club, by the way. A little moan just went through the crowd. And this ecstasy hit me, man. I took it and it washed over me and I didn't even feel Jewish anymore. Everything cleared up, man. Everything just washed away. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to need this AA thing, man. And it wore off. You know, it always wears off. And the next morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, I woke up, put on my best clothes, got a bad check to write you, and went down to report to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hit this 7 a.m. meeting, man, and you know these meetings. People are just hanging on by a thread at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know. Most of them had their underwear on the outside of their clothes, you know. And I walk in there, you know, just every part of my face is moving in a different direction. You know, I got that newcomer look. I'm leaving a trail of light when I walk. You know these guys, right? And I sat down and I'm a major guy and I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't believe it. And I stayed and I don't know why I stayed. If you're new here, I hope you're out of plans. I think I stayed because I was out of plans. And if you're new here, I hope you are out of plans. If you're new here and you have a plan, it's probably a butte. Don't use your plan. We want to know your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. That's what, actually the book I've always wanted to see is the collection of newcomer plans. That's... Man. And I kept coming back, and I don't know why, and I started bringing the money home. And I stayed around Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months and enjoyed the gift of step none. I was 6 months sober. I was completely out of my mind. I was suffering from untreated alcoholism, and I didn't even know I had it. But I saw people, you know how you see people get up to the podium and share their way right out of the doors? Get nuttier and nuttier every week, see them get more and more toxic, and just share their way right out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw it happening, and I saw the kids, my kids, become a little less frightened. And my wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups. One of the most hurtful and confusing things to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was I sat in AA meetings and I heard people telling jokes about Al-Anon. I'm not talking about good-natured jokes. God knows we have enough good-natured jokes around about alcoholism. I'm talking about mean jokes. And I'll tell you why I found it so confusing. I was very proud of my wife for attending Al-Anon family groups, going to their meetings, and reaching out for her own miracle. I was really proud of her. And when I heard some of these jokes, I didn't understand yet that the people who were telling were ignorant, but I judge no man, had no idea of what they were talking about, had no idea of the function and the work that's done in Al-Anon family groups, but felt the need to talk about it in public. And I didn't know that yet. And I just, you know, if you're doing that, then I guess you're casting, I get one vote in AA. I used to get all the votes, now I just get one. And I say to myself, isn't this a good thing? Isn't this what we're supposed to be working toward? And again, I didn't get it. I didn't get it because I hadn't been around to other meetings where people understood the Al-Anon family groups and what was going on. And I also had not started attending Al-Anon meetings, which have certainly enriched my life immensely. And if you are doing that, then I guess you're casting your vote that it's okay. And I get to cast my vote. My vote is that it's not okay. And the reason why I'm casting my vote is that I get to, and I'm the guy with the microphone, which, you know. And I found it very confusing and very hurtful. At any rate, I was 6 months sober, and I knew I was going to drink. And I was out of plans, and I asked a guy to sponsor me. This guy, man, he talked about God, and he didn't sound like a sap to me. He seemed to be happy a lot of the time, but not that, you know, brain dead, moony happy, you know, like really genuinely happy. Also, I knew he had been a bad guy. Thank you, Norm. You know how you can tell that they've been a bad guy? You look in their eyes, you see them little bunny rabbits and antelope hopping around in there, you know. You know the guy's come back from a really bad place. And I asked this guy to sponsor me, and he took me to his apartment. He made sure I had done some reading in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to his apartment, and he spent hours with me that day, for fun and for free. Thank you, Darrell. I didn't know why the guy was doing it. And He read chapter 5 to me. He took me through the first two steps. And on the way through, we made a decision together, and we got on our knees and we prayed together. And I made a decision. And I took step 3, and then he went back and he gave me the instructions in the fourth step. And my life started. All hell broke loose for me. And you know, it's a funny thing, because some people share that they mostly resented themselves. And I believe them. I believe that's true for them. I also know it's not true for me. I hated me, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I hated you so much more than I hated myself. I can't even describe it to you. I am not a suicide person. I'm a homicide person. I vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have, you know? And I'm not knocking the suicide people, all right? It's kind of the flip side of the same coin, in a way. So I did this inventory. By the time I was 9 months sober, I came back and read it to my sponsor. And in my first year of sobriety, I fancied myself a show business big shot. I had been, my first year, I had this writing job for 20th Century Fox. And by the end of the year, I had wanted this job directing a situation comedy in Los Angeles. And I didn't get the job. And I already done my inventory by this time, which qualifies you for the 10th step. And I almost drank. And I went to my sponsor and I told him what had happened. I was humiliated. And he said, "Well, I guess, you know, Scott, I guess you got the show business god." And the show business god failed you. You didn't get that job. And, you know, you come into AA and you hear about God getting people jobs, getting them into relationships. You hear about God getting people parking spaces, you know. Not the parking god. Not the parking god. Oh, no. What if you don't get a space? What do, you know? And I understood what Don was saying. I had to get a god not involved in parking. I had to get a god big enough so a lot of stuff could happen in his universe and I didn't get to drink, who wasn't involved with show business. So I did my 10 step. I was resentful at myself for almost drinking. I was resentful at that company for not giving me the job. And I did step 6 and 7. And I did my prayer and I said, "Father, I am willing to do anything. You can have show business too. Take this too. Just keep me sober. Don't let me drink. I'll do anything." And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up on that catering truck. I looked up and I said, "I didn't mean this. No, I didn't mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding." Now, I had a job catering on location for TV and movies because the catering truck follows these people around. You make a lot of dough, but God forbid I should make money, bring it home, and give it to my family. I was humiliated by the, you know, and the first movie that I catered, the executive producer and the star was a guy who I had worked with in the business. And he stuck his head on the truck that morning and he said, "Can I have a burrito, Scott?" And I turned around and said, "What's happening, man?" He said, "Is this your truck?" I said, "No, but it's my spatula." I called my sponsor and I said, "Oh, we're getting the gift now, pal." "Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a miracle." He said, "Sounds like you've got a resentment." "What, they go to retreats to learn this? You better sit yourself down and write you a 10th step. I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A 5-bagger for sure." What am I going to ask God to take away? I'm not. Resentment is no big deal. It's just the great destroyer of all alcoholics, the source of all spiritual illness. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, take your ass out, and kill you dead, but don't be alarmed. Work a step a year. Don't hear that pearl very much anymore. What am I going to ask God to remove? I'm dying. I'm dying. Do I ask him to remove the truck, the guy, the burrito? What am I going to ask God to take away? What? Blue skies. God's got a magic wand. He comes, touches me on the head. What poison in me that's killing me, if it disappeared like this, would it be gone? What are the defects of character in me that if God were to remove, this resentment would be gone? I have false pride. I'm grandiose. How dare a man of my caliber be working on a kitchen truck, making money, and bringing it to my family? I'm playing God. Things aren't going according to the Scott Redmond program. a fabulous program. Oh, man. I'm impatient. Things aren't moving along. I'm not trusting in God. If I did, I'd know everything was okay. And this is the list I had to go. And I had a resentment at the guy. I don't know what for. Being hungry. I mean, the guy didn't rub it in. He wanted a burrito. He was nice to me, but I was so humiliated. You see, I still didn't get it, man. I didn't get it that there's no place to fall from here. That the top rank in Alcoholics Anonymous is child of God. And once you achieve that, you have no height to fall from. You know? But I didn't get it. I thought I had fallen from that height. And I was resentful at God for putting me on the kitchen truck. God had gotten up that morning and said, let's keep Saturn on its axis and put Scott Redman on a kitchen truck. What is this? This thinking is insane. That God, get the Redman boy. Get the Redman boy. And I started cooking for a living, and I wanted to be able to carry the message by dealing with overwhelming financial success and showing people how to do it with grace. I thought humility was going to be presented to me at a ceremony. I was going to get the humility cutlass and hat and sash, and I didn't know that it was going to be taught to me in a vastly different manner. My sponsor kept saying to me, Scott, show up every day and give them a dime for their nickel, man. And I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors and my stage managers. One day, I'm getting the hang of it. I'm writing these 10 steps, starting to sponsor other guys. You know, it's happening for me. You know, and I'm serving lunch, and these two actresses that I had directed in a soap opera are coming down the line, and I get ready. You know, I'm a man of God now. I have God. I'm filled with God and with grace, and I'm ready. I've got my ladle there. I'm ready. You know, to say no. I'm with God, and I'm fine. You know. They didn't recognize me. They just said, keep the gravy off the potatoes. You know, that's all they were interested in. Didn't get to have my humility moment. And I worked real hard, and I was able to, one of the
sponsors had been a big rock and roll star. He had really done a lot of stuff in the music industry and had a lot of hit records. Him and another guy, my sponsors, a 17-year-old kid, and they had a job digging fence posts in the San Fernando Valley together. And the kid starts laughing because my friend Dave, like I, had still thought he had fallen from a height, you know. And the kid starts laughing, and David says, "What's so funny?" And the kid goes, "Well, you know, I always wanted to hang out with rock and roll stars, and here we are." And I got right with it, and I became proud of the work that I was doing. And I started getting it. And also, a friend of mine named Paul had a prayer he used to say. He was also in show business, and he used to say, "Father, I'm willing to do anything, just keep me sober, but just don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott." It's a pleasure to be a help, you know? But I really started to get it. And then I got offered this, I was cooking for about 3 years, and I got offered this big comedy writing job by a company called Ketchum Public Relations. They had me do a videotape. I wanted this job. I started getting the old brain fever back. My mind reading skills kicked in. You know, we don't need any psychic hotline. Alcoholics, we don't need you, Dion. You know, we got that mind reading thing going like nobody's business. And I crashed and burned before I even heard about it. I got the brain fever, that untreated alcoholism where the vein on your head is pumping like a garden hose, you know that. And before I even heard about it, I released it, I wrote a 10-step, I got God involved, and I cut it loose. A couple of weeks later, I got a call from Ketchum, and they said, "You didn't get the job," and I was fine with it, from New York. I hang up the phone rings, and it's the catering company, and they said, "Can you cater a commercial up in Lake Arrowhead?" I said, "Yeah." Got in the truck and got up there, and I grabbed the call sheet, and the commercial was for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. I look at the call sheet, and then I look down at the end of the truck, and there's a guy with a videotape camera there. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, we're taping the making of this commercial." They're taping my humiliation. They're going to tape it. They're going to take it to New York, and the guys in New York are going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf? Oh, poor son of a bitch. You know, if we had only known. So I call my sponsor, and I said, yeah, we're getting the gift now, pal. Yeah, we're really getting the gift now, and the miracle's bigger. He said, I guess God had enough writers, he needed a few cooks today. Then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum, you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. As long as he's having a good time, folks. When it came time to do my 8-step list when I was 9 months sober, I put my sons on the list, I put my wife on the list, and I didn't want to put my father down, and my sponsor said, do you owe him an amends? And I said, yeah. He said, put him down. I said, Don, my dad's dead. He said, Scott, I know, put him on the list. I said, what am I going to do? And Don said, I don't know. I don't know. Why don't you do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous and you'll find out. So I had to make amends to my wife and my kids. What was I going to sit down the boys and say, gee, boys, I'm sorry you've had no life. Forgive me? I don't think so. I had to start acting like a dad, and I didn't know how to do it. In my first couple of months in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard people sharing, and I kept saying to myself, I haven't hurt my kids. At least I haven't hurt my kids. I haven't done what these people have done. And I was in a couple of months, and I was on the phone with a guy, and a memory came to me that absolutely splattered me. I remembered that a couple of weeks before I had gotten sober, I was hungover from drugs and alcohol. I was with my older son. We were swimming, and I got sick in front of him, and he got sick, as sometimes will happen if somebody sees that kind of thing. And what happened on the phone is I realized that the only reason my beautiful, blonde, perfect baby was sick that morning was not because he had eaten bad food, not because he had a virus, not because he had been hit, was because he was with his father. And if he hadn't been with his father, he wouldn't have been sick. And it was so clear to me that it just crushed me enough to be able to stick around Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to start acting like a dad, and I didn't know how to do it. And I had to follow the guys around in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had to learn how to be a father from watching. You know, I learned about being a father by watching men sponsor other men. Kindly. You know, some people like tough love, and I'm not interested in it. I never have been. Why would I possibly need your help in being mean to me? You can't do me like I do me anyway. You know, and I'm not talking about telling people the truth and being firm with them. I'm just talking about being mean. I just stayed away from the mean guys. And I went to drowning people and asked for swimming lessons my whole life, you know. Then I get pissed off when they could only say glub, 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 you know. But I always went to people for things they didn't have available, and for some bizarre reason, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I actually started going to people for stuff that they had. And I started coaching flag football, doing lame stuff, you know, coaching Little League. Instead of saying to my kids, go do your homework, I started saying, do you need any help with your homework? My kids never had the right stuff. They never had the right jeans, the right folder. I'm not talking about a lot of money. I'm talking about a few dollars, you know. And the days where it was given to them, it was given to them with such insane, inappropriate exuberance and excitement, it still felt tainted. It felt dirty. They felt cut out from the pack, you know. And I had to start spending heroin money on bicycles and cocaine money on books and alcohol money on clothing. And I had to start acting like a dad, and it was real hard. I felt like I was going insane sometimes, alone in the house while Nancy was at an Al-Anon meeting. It's just me and the kids and this bag of squirrels, man, you know? And when I came in to AA, I heard people talking about their brain in the third person as if it was an unwanted alien dashing about their house and planning their undoing. And I said, geez, that's how I feel right now. Do you have anything else? And in fact, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous does not say your head's out to get you once you've started doing the work. It says sanity will have been restored by the 10th step. The alcohol problem will be removed. In step 11, it says what used to be the occasional hunch or inspiration will slowly become a working part of the mind. That means that wow stays, which is kind of nice because I always wanted it to and it never did. And my sons found an entire class of grown-up who was terrified of them. And that was the new men who came to my house. And when Jesse was about 7, I brought this guy over, and Jesse walked up to him and said, what step you working, pal? And I'd come into the house sometimes, and they'd be browbeating a guy. You know, a guy'd be on the couch, and they'd be doing this to him and stuff. And and they stopped being so scared. And by the time I was a couple of years sober, my son Micah, who was so scared he could barely read or write, I was making the boys lunch, and I said to Mike, "What do you want on your hot dog?" And he said, "I want mustard, onions, and lettuce." And I said, "Lettuce?" He said, "Yeah, oh, yeah, okay, I don't want lettuce." And he walked away, and he came back about 45 minutes later, and he looked at me directly in the eyes, and I'm not altering one syllable. He said, "I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for." So I asked him to sponsor me at that point. What's that? What's that? Where does that come from? You know? I had to be there when my oldest son needed to ask his father, "How do you ask a girl how to dance?" And I know I never possibly could have been there if I was still on my cups. And if I had been there, I don't know. Doesn't much matter. And I had to stop working on my marriage. I had to stop working on my relationship. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. Is to talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over, and on the way down you go, okay. I had to start working on getting closer to God, and maybe if I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, he could give me back a Scott Redmond that would be worth taking to a relationship. And Nancy and I really started working on ourselves. And when I say working on ourselves, I mean working on being of service and working the steps and getting out of self and trying to bring that to the marriage. And we avoided each other in our marriage for a long time. When I was new in AA and I told my family I was going to a meeting, they went, "Bye." Good. Goodbye. And if you take a look at our sexual inventory, we're asked to write about 7 different points. If you're new here, I'm sure you're thrilled that there's a sexual inventory. If you haven't heard about it before, your eyes are probably about this wide. And we're asked to write about 7 different points. This is on page 69 of the sexual inventory, and it says, write about where we've been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, where have we unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness, and what should we do instead? What should we have done? Not what could I have done. What could I have done? What I did. What should I have done? I shouldn't have been in the state. I shouldn't have talked to that person. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have lied. And it says on the bottom of the page, in this way we try to shape a sound ideal for our future life, future sex life, for me, future life. I get to write about the guy I always wanted to be and could never, by the time I got to the drink, I couldn't act like that guy. And on the bottom of the page it says, we ask God what to do in each individual situation. The right answers will come if we want them. Not if we like them, if we want them. Where have I been selfish? I want what I want when I want it. Where have I been dishonest? Well, I can lie in my marriage a million different ways. I clean the house. You might think it's because I like a clean house, but no. I think that if you do a certain amount of housework, you should be rewarded with a certain amount of sex. That there should be conversion tables on the back of cleaning products, that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex for a certain duration of time. So, I mean, this is the one I came up with when I said, why is cleaning the house making me so pissed off? Because it's not that I'm a grown man who should live in a clean house. No. I got this other agenda. And I'm dishonest. I'm lying. I'm using cleaning the house as a tool to try to bully someone instead of just doing my job as a grown man. Inconsiderate, I don't much care how you feel about it. Where have I unjustifiably aroused jealousy? If you don't do it my way, I just might look at someone or talk about someone in a way that will be hurtful to you. Suspicion, if I stop telling you how I feel and I freeze you out, I can get your mind reading skills going because it's a crapshoot, right? Suspicion and bitterness, the previous 5 create the bitterness. What should I do instead? How about if I tell my wife what I need without telling her what to do? What if I can overcome a fear of confrontation? I know how to crush it back down, right? And then eventually climb into a clock tower with a high-powered rifle and start killing people. I know how to do that fine. I know how to retaliate and just scream. I know how to use the tyranny of helplessness and cry until you do what I want you to do. But to tell you what I need without telling you what to do, that's something. That's something unbelievable. And I had to start practicing this in my marriage. And instead of telling my wife what to do, I started asking for help. Because, people want to help you. They really do. When you're not busy bullying them and doing all that plotting, people really do want to be helpful to us. And instead of bossing people around, when I ask for help, I've gotten some pretty remarkable results. And our marriage started getting healthy. And I kept doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. In my first year, I was online to buy some lunch, and there was a guy in front of me, and he was buying a can of Colt 45 malt liquor with, change and lint, and a half-eaten milk dud. The guy had been there, for a week. You know the guy, right? And he turned around and looked at me, and instead of in my best Bronx saying, "What are you looking at?" I said, "How you doing?" He said, "You don't know how I'm doing. Nobody knows how I'm doing except for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous." So we went outside and we exchanged phone numbers, and that night I went on my first real 12-step call. I got a guy with more time than me, and we were told by some people to take him down to County USC Hospital and dump him off at the door. Don't go in with him. Don't show them that he's got any resources. Just leave him at the door. I don't know why, but we went through the whole process. We went in with him. We went through the whole process all the way up to the alcoholic ward with the guy. And about halfway through, he turns to us and he says, "I feel like I'm dying." And the guy I'm with time, says, "That's because you are." And I pulled the guy with time aside. I said, "What? How can you say such a cold and sensitive thing to this guy? I want him to like us, right? I don't want him not to like us." And what's the guy supposed to say? This guy's at a county facility. He's been told to lie that he's got blood in his urine to break his way into an alcoholic ward. What is the guy supposed to say? "You're just having a bad day." No, you're not having a bad day. This is what dying feels like. I'll let you know when you're having a bad day. This isn't it. And yet, if you stick around Alcoholics Anonymous for any appreciable amount of time, you will see men and women come into this program with bottoms that will make your hair stand on end. You will look at that man or woman and you will say, "Well, there's no way he can drink again. Not with what he's been through. There's no way. That guy's going to be sober forever." And yet, if they stick around here and they don't treat their disease with the program of action outlined in our book, it won't be their bottom anymore. It will be a bad day. A bad day. It's a period of time where people were thinking behind their back and being really mean to them. It won't be their bottom, and you'll see them share their way right out of the door and get on with the business of living. And it's a bone-chilling sight to see, and I hope it never stops chilling my bones. Sometime after this, a guy who I sponsored called me up and said, "Look, get off my back, man, and stop with all this God crap and this book crap, and leave me alone." And then he went out and ripped some people off in the program. He stole some money, stole a car, he ripped off an apartment. He was making me look pretty bad. And I wanted to sit him down and explain a few things to him. And my sponsor said, Dr. Bob, at the end of his nightmare, says he one of the reasons he didn't drink, even though he was obsessed with drinking for the first 2.5 years of his sobriety, he says, "I had so frightfully abused my right to drink, I had lost it." And my sponsor said, "You've so frightfully abused your opinion of other people, you've lost the right to express it." And he said, "Why don't you sit down and write a 10th step? I'm resentful at blank for ripping people off in AA and making me look bad. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex." Little knock on the crotch there, a little ego blow. "What are the defects of character that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone?" "Well, I'm self-centered. Selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking are the same, but they're different, right? Selfish is kind of wanting it all for me. Self-seeking is kind of trying to figure out what's in it for me. And self-centered is figuring it's all about me. Right? And when I'm talking to God, I like to try to get as specific as I can, because otherwise I'm just saying, "Father, I'm yours." And he says, I knew that. I'm God. It's a very nice gesture. I really appreciate it, but I am God. This is my deal. What do you mean? And when I say, can you take this? Can you, it's killing me. Can you take this and reveal your work to me? When we drew closer to him, he revealed himself to us. Can you do my work? Let me know what your work is. That's a relationship. That's the relationship with God that I have found in step 6 and 7. Can you please take this for me? Can you please show me what I can do for you? What can I do for you? Otherwise, I got God running all over town doing crap for me, and I don't know what to do for him. I was a people pleaser. I cared more about how I was seen in AA than what this guy was going through. Again, I was self-centered. I didn't steal anything. He did. Right? I was impatient, impatient with his recovery, and I was playing God. And this is the list I had to do and that I had to take to God in step 6 and 7. And sometime after this, this guy found out that he had a fatal illness, and he called the city agency, and they said, all we can do is take you down to county general and dump you off at the door. I knew that that wasn't true because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he couldn't call anybody else because either the people around him, he had burned him out, or they had told him what they thought of him. And I was the only guy he could call, and I got to be there for him because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to be there for this guy during his death when I couldn't be there for my father, and my father came back into my life, and the amends was made, and I felt his presence again. I felt his presence. I was able to tell his grandsons about him, and I had my dad back. I had my dad back, and I had and have a relationship with him today. My father was had an expansive sense of humor, and he was always funniest when he was mad. And when my brother and I would fight over something in the car, my father would grab it and throw it out of the window and say, "Fight's over." And it wasn't until much later in life I said, "Why didn't we fight over Mom?" You know, that would have cleared up a lot of problems, actually. If you're new here, I don't know what you're coming in with. I don't know what your deal is. I don't know what the thing is or the things are that you're never going to overcome. It says in our book that once the past, the dark past, is placed in God's hands, and we place it in his hands with this work. Once we place it in his hands, we can help others avert death and misery. We never close the door on our dark past. We use it. Because if you are an alcoholic and you're equipped with facts about yourself, you can attain the confidence of an alcoholic in a matter of minutes. You can get a result that normally could never happen or would take years to happen, to take place. And I'm pretty grandiose, and help others avert death and misery fits right fine on a business card for me. I don't mind that job at all, you know. I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're, you know, if you've strangled a puppy, we got a guy who strangled two puppies. You know, one of the guys I sponsor, before he came in, he got drunk, got into his truck, and drove 19 miles in the wrong direction on the Ventura Freeway, and then drove off a 100-foot embankment. And I was telling my sons about this, and I said, you know, and Jim was declared dead at the scene, and Jesse said, yeah, and dumb. I don't know what you've got to overcome, and we're not going to play Can You Bottom This, but we could. We could, you know. Our problem mainly rests in our mind. If it didn't mainly rest in our mind, and if you do want to read the section in our book about a physical allergy, I want to urge you, if you're new, to read the doctor's opinion in our book. It was written by a non-alcoholic, a guy who was one of the directors of one of the most prestigious hospitals dedicated to the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction in the United States. A non-alcoholic, and in his book, he says, in his section of our book, he says, you might ask yourself, why am I a medical man? We all know medicine is an industry on some level, right? And he says, why would I sponsor an altruistic spiritual society I don't make dollar one on? And then he goes on to say, if you don't get that, come work with me. Come see the destroyed families, the destroyed children. Come hear the sound of a man who wants to get sober and who can't. And then he says something that startles me every time I read it. He says, let it become part of your waking hours and your sleeping hours. He was obviously dreaming about it. He was dreaming about people he couldn't help. Come and do this, and you won't wonder why I'm sponsoring this society. And then in the second and third chapters of our book, it discusses this kind of bizarre, tweaked thinking. There's a couple of lists in there. There's a list of things people say about us. You know, why can't he lay off the hard stuff? You think he gets sober for her. The doctor said, you know, he'd be dead if he drank again, and there he is all lit up. And there's also a list of things we say about ourselves, like, How did it happen again? I'll stop after the second one. What the hell? I've had one. I might as well go ahead and finish it off. And behind both of these lists, there's a world of misunderstanding. And after the second and third chapters, it brings us to the chapter about the physical malady. And this physical malady, which seems to keep us perpetuated in this bizarre thinking, which dooms us to take the first drink. And once we put the drink in our body, we can't stop drinking. And the spiritual sickness starts hurting ourselves and everybody around us. And our problem mainly rests in our mind. If it didn't, why would we continue to take that first drink despite its attendant misery and suffering? I was talking to a newcomer some months ago. I met him at a meeting. He was 2 weeks sober. He called me and he talked to me for an hour. I said, four times so he'd know I wasn't dead. In his talk, he told me that he had been stalking a couple of women and he had a restraining order out against him, but he's 2 weeks sober now and all of that's different. And at the end of his hour of talking to me, he said, I feel so all alone. And I said, well, I don't even know you, and I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting. What do you mean you feel all alone? He said, I mean, I don't have a woman. And I said, well, what will you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the party, pal? What a catch, huh? People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia are not having dating problems. All right, but alcoholics do. Some time ago, Nancy was walking through our bedroom, and I was on the phone with a new guy, and all she heard me say was, let's say the aliens are coming. She stopped dead in the room. She wasn't going to miss this for a second. That's an outside interest. I'm not saying the aliens aren't coming, all right? I'm asking you one question, pal. Why are they coming for you? You're 2 weeks sober. You have no life. Why have they gone across a galaxy for you? He's sleeping with the Bible on his chest to ward them off. They're going to come across the galaxy, walk into his apartment and say, oh no, the Bible, get back in their spaceship and leave. Our problem mainly rests in our mind. If you're new here, this is the only text about a fatal illness, and I got to hear Paul say this when I was brand new, and it stuck in my mind, man, and it's never left me, that this is the only text on a fatal illness he had ever seen or read that contains the sentence, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. There's no book about cholera that says cholera's a hoot. You'll love cholera. It's a scream. You'll meet other people with cholera. You'll have a fabulous time. And then you'll meet people who just caught cholera. It doesn't get any better than that. If you're new here, I want to welcome you and I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to stick around here and get a diagnosis. Just find out if you have alcoholism. Just stick around here long enough to catch it. Again, I want to thank you all for having me down today. And if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks for letting me share.